What makes the State of Israel both a triumph and a tragedy? Ari Shavit joins us to talk about his new book, My Promised Land.
I'm afraid that what you see in Israel as well, and in the attitudes to Israel, that the balance was lost.
Just how personal does Ann Patchett get in her book, This is the Story of a Happy Marriage? We'll talk to her about her new collection of essays.
You know, of all the essays in the book, that was the one I didn't want to put in. It felt too personal, too old. It really made me uncomfortable.
Julie Bosman joins us with Notes from the Field. And Greg Coles has bestseller news. This is Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Pamela Paul.
This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 150,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audible.com/bookreview.
Ari Shavit is the author of My Promised Land, The Triumph and Tragedy of Israel, reviewed on this week's cover by Leon Wieseltier, and he joins us here now. Ari, thank you so much for coming.
Great to be here.
So your subtitle here is The Triumph and Tragedy of Israel, but you start off talking about the tragedy. What is that? What is that tragedy?
The tragedy is basically the conflict. What I claim in this book, and I try to describe, because the book is not polemic book. I tell a story. I'm not making an argument. But the argument in the story is that Zionism, the successful attempt to create a Jewish national home, was brilliant in two ways and flawed in a third way. And this is the tension that I think is with us for over 100 years, and we see it daily. So it was brilliant because there was a need to build a national home for the Jews, one for physical reasons, because in Europe they were about to be murdered. And the second is that because Zionism, in a sense, saw in advance the challenges that American Jews now see in the Pew Report, which is the difficulty to maintain non-Orthodox Jewish civilization in the diaspora. So Zionism was brilliant in seeing these two great needs of the Jews, especially non-Orthodox Jews, to have a state of their own. But the flaw was that they did not see the Palestinians who were there, who were not defined yet as Palestinians, but Arabs, and became Palestinians later. So the tension between the need, the remarkable achievement of creating this state, and the flaw, which is that the conflict was there to begin with. It was built into the project. And this is why the conflict is such a deep one, long one, and one that is so difficult to resolve.
And when you say that they didn't see the Palestinians, you mean they really actually didn't see them, didn't consider them, and you tell the story of your own family.
Well, they probably saw that they were there, but conceptually, yes. And again, because I try to be, you know, this is a book that is, first of all, loves Israel, but is allowed because I love Israel so much and I committed to Israel so much, I allow myself to be very critical and brutally honest about it. And I think that when I describe my great-grandfather coming to the land in 1897, there are some good reasons why he was not aware of the Arab presence there. And one is that there was no Palestinian people. The Palestinians did not define themselves yet as a people. It was all part of this Middle East chaos under the Turkish Empire. It was very different from what we see today. So there was no, they were not invading a country or a nation. It was a land that was undefined politically. So you can understand that. The other issue was that they were thinking of a much larger country, including Jordan, and so a land that would have had place for everybody in it. So there are some things to be said in their defense. But at the end of the day, they did not see that while they had their dream and while they were trying to create their utopia, they were running into a tragic conflict and clash with other people, a clash that is with us to this day.
Here in the States, we often see this as a conflict between Israelis and Palestinians. But as you pointed out earlier, this this need for Israel had to do with an identity that was separate from the Orthodox, and that there is, you write about the conflicts between various groups within Israel. What do you see as the conflict between the Orthodox and secular Israel?
I think that there is an ironic, almost even tragic situation here. Why? Because the real Orthodox Judaism is in no jeopardy. Orthodox Judaism can exist in this country, in Europe, anywhere, because it's a brilliant diaspora idea. If you live within a ghetto and you have God, you can remain Jewish in Belgium, in Poland, in Brooklyn, wherever. The ones who have a problem maintaining their Jewish identity are the non-Orthodox Jews. So their need for Israel is actually much greater, much deeper than the need of the Orthodox. But tragically, what happened is that Israel was gradually overtaken, not totally overtaken, but the, let's put it, the Orthodox and ultra-Orthodox coloring of it became much stronger in recent decades.
This is just a demographic.
It's demographic and politics. It has several elements. And the result is that it alienates American progressive Jews, especially young American progressive Jews, who are the ones who actually need Israel, and Israel needs them. And if there is a plea beyond my book here, and when coming to this country with a book, is really to try to have progressive American Jews and progressive Israeli Jews work together, because both really need Israel, but they need an Israel that is progressive, democratic, liberal, just, an Israel that tries to end occupation, an Israel that does not, that respects the rights of women, the rights of minorities, the rights of gays. We need all that. Now, a lot of that is there in Israel. Israel is a free society, it's a vibrant democracy. But because of occupation on the one hand and the ultra-Orthodox pressures on the other, this more benign Israel that we all want is in constant struggle with the dark forces in Israel that alienate American Jews.
You mentioned women, and I don't know, do you talk about women in the book? Because that comes up with this Orthodox issue, and there were headlines here recently about women being harassed in public, and there's the whole issue with the wall.
You know, we are journalists, so we have to report about reality, but we are aware of it that sometimes there are some distortions as a result of what reports. So on the one hand, terrible, outrageous things do happen, and we have to fight them. So there were some difficult instances of segregation of women, of things that are totally unacceptable. On the other hand, again, I urge anyone listening to us to put this in context, because basically Israel is still a very free society. Most Israelis resemble non-religious or non-conservative, even, I would say, Americans in many ways. Israel is basically hedonistic, creative, sexy, lively. I mean, this darker Israel is there. I mean, there are these ultra-Orthodox ghettos, and these people have too much political power, which is a main problem. But most of the lives of most Israelis are really alive, are free. In many ways, you know, Israel is almost anarchic. I mean, we should not accept these phenomena. We have to fight these forces. I would say there is a struggle between this Tea Party Israel and progressive Israel. But Tea Party Israel is still a minority. We have to fight it, but let's not overblow this.
Is it that Israel is held up to this sort of impossible standard that we expect, you know?
There are two issues here. One, yes, I think that there are many Jews and non-Jews who have, because of Jewish history, because, you know, from the Bible on, from Jewish morality, and then on top of that, the Holocaust. There is this some expectation that Jews will be saints. This is unfair, because we were saints. We were powerless for so many years, and this saintly Judaism ended in Auschwitz. I think it's unfair to demand of the Jews to repeat that experience. The lessons of Auschwitz for us is that we must have power. We must act within the world we live in. We must use force if needed, we must defend ourselves. And yet, we must remain just. We have to strike the balance. And I'm afraid that what you see in Israel as well, and in the attitudes to Israel, that the balance was lost. On the one hand, you have brutal forces who are eager to use force and are politically and morally flawed. On the other hand, you have these purists who really expect Israel to be something it cannot be, and it's unfair to demand that of it.
Moving away from the arguments, I mean, so many, to talk a little bit about the structure of the book, because there are so many argument type of books about Israel, but you really structured this as a series of moments and also integrated a lot of interviews and sort of narrative history in there, as well as your own personal history, even though it's not a memoir. How did you come to structure the book in this way and balance all of these elements?
Probably the most difficult year, I wrote this book for 5 years, probably the most difficult year was the first one, because I knew all the things I wanted to do and I didn't yet know how do I do them all. And I must say I'm very happy that I feel that at the end of the day, in the long journey, I managed to do that. Look, I felt and I still feel that there are so many books about Israel that were either polemics or history or academic. And some of them are great books, and I love reading them, and I respect the people who wrote them. But for a long time, for a generation, there has not been a classic nonfiction personal book by an Israeli about Israel. And I think that what happened is that we lost our own narrative in Israel, and the people concerned about Israel lost the narrative of Israel. And what I try to do here, I think, is two or three things. One, to bring it back to the human level, not to make I tell the history, but I tell it not like a professional historian, which I'm not. I tell it through the life stories and experiences of individuals. So I thought it was very important in order to really get this, again, both the triumph and the tragedy, to bring it down to the human level. The other thing was to find the significant detail, the person or the place or the thing that represents a larger picture. And I think that's, I must say, I loved doing that. And if I contributed here something to in a kind of different kind of genre, then I'm very, that's something I'm very proud of. And the third thing I did is really to transcend the tribal, political, polarized narratives. I have my own views. Generally, I'm perceived as left or center or radical center or something like that. But my role here was not to put forward my own ideology. Mm-hmm. I tried to understand everybody. I tried to listen to everybody, to understand everybody. First of all, because I think many people have like elements of truth in them. The basic thing about Israel and the Middle East is that it's very complex. Anyone with a simplistic idea, a simplistic wrong approach is wrong. And I tried to wrestle with this complexity, but not only in a logical and political, analytical way, but in an emotional way, in a personal way. So the book is not only transcends right, left, and centrist right. narratives, but it also combines the rational in me with the emotional and with the personal. And I think in this sense, it's multi-layered three times over. It was ambitious. It was dangerous. I hope it works.
And you move in a chronology, and some of the moments you chose are sort of the obvious ones, and others not so much. Was there one that you knew you wanted to include that maybe was most important to you on both that rational and emotional level?
Which is the most important chapter here? Or
yes.
The most important?
Is it 1948?
No, absolutely not.
Oh, interesting.
48, which got much attention and for good reasons, is a very important chapter, and I totally stand behind it, and I understand why many people think it is the most important. But in my mind, because just to tell our listeners, this is the chapter that deals with the 48 war and really with the real catastrophe that happened to the Palestinians as individuals at that war, which I think is their formative trauma and something that it's my moral duty to acknowledge and recognize, something not always done by pro-Israelis and Israelis. But in my mind, the most important chapter is the chapter following it. That's mm-hmm. the chapter describing the 1950s. What I do in this chapter is I take the lives of several individuals, some of them rather well-known, like the writer Aaron Appelfeld and the Chief Justice Aaron Barak, some less well-known. And I describe their Holocaust experiences as children. It's pretty short, but I think it's pretty shocking. And then their arrival in Israel, and then what happens to them in the first years. And then I gather it all into a housing project or housing estate where these survivors of the Holocaust live in the early 50s. And these people are the people I love most, because these people who really came from death, these are the ultimate victims of the 20th century and of history. And yet these people did not go into revenge feelings. They did not go into national extremism. They did not become suicide bombers, and they did not become chauvinist nationalists. They tried to save themselves, to educate their kids, to build a life, although they were in many ways human wrecks. So this Israel of the 1950s is, in my mind, really miraculous, really virtuous. And this is, in the sense, the spirit that I hope Israel today will go back to, because we've lost some of that.
Mm-hmm.
And my dream is for Israel to go back to that so impressive spirit and ethos that it had in the 1950s.
All right. Well, that gives us much to discuss and debate. And we're going into both the Thanksgiving weekend, which is, of course, a kind of national holiday here, and one in which we think about our own identity as a country, and Hanukkah. So I imagine that come the weekend, there'll be much discussion of this. Ari Shavit, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
The book is My Promised Land, The Triumph and Tragedy of Israel, by Ari Shavit, reviewed on the cover this week by Leon Wieseltier.
This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks, with more than 150,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, and featuring audio versions of many New York Times bestsellers. Audible is offering listeners of this podcast a free audiobook when you try Audible free for 30 days. One audiobook to consider is Churchill and the King, The Wartime Alliance of Winston Churchill and George VI by Kenneth Weisbrod. That's Churchill and the King by Kenneth Weisbrod, and it's available on Audible. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audible.com/bookreview. That's audible.com/bookreview.
Julie Bosman is here. Hi, Julie.
Hi, Pamela.
So last night, the National Book Awards. Tell us.
Well, I was sitting in the press pen in the back of the room, unlike some of my New York Times colleagues who are sitting at the tables among the 1%. But I had a great vantage point. This was a very, very big National Book Award ceremony. There were more than 700 people there, an increase from previous years, and the ballroom at Cipriani was quite full indeed. And it was an interesting ceremony. I was kind of getting morning after thoughts from various people who were there. And I was just talking to a publisher who thought that the whole evening was sort of a downer, that everyone who accepted awards was talking about, you know, their sad stories and crying. And of course, Yale Doctorow's speech about the internet, which definitely lowered the temperature in the room a few degrees. And I know there was a lot of snickering from the press pen, but that's not unusual.
I guess it was hard to stay at the level of Maya Angelou with the Rainbow in the Clouds that started off the evening when Toni Morrison gave her an award.
Yes, but even that, I mean, Maya Angelou, I think, really, you know, lifted everyone up with her wonderful just being there.
And her singing.
But it was a little nerve-wracking when Toni Morrison, who, you know, didn't seem to be in great health, walked up the stairs and couldn't catch her breath and
right.
kind of wheezing a little bit. And that was, you know, made people a little bit nervous. But I thought that maybe that was the high point of the evening. And then after that,
these two really giants of African-American literature.
Absolutely. Who talked very personally about their friendship. I think Toni Morrison had that great anecdote about how when a family member died and Maya's was the first non-family member voice that she heard on the phone, and how important that was to her. So it was a really nice demonstration of, you know, these renowned authors and of their friendship, which was lovely. But it was, there were a lot of surprises, I thought. I mean, I think that I suppose we should go through the winners.
But, yes. And the winners are?
The winners are James McBride, who won the fiction award. You know, that was, even though he was on the cover of the New York Times Book Review, it was a little bit of a surprise. I think people were not really expecting him. If there was... I mean, it's all speculation, of course. We have the long list of 10 authors, and then it's shortened down to 5 finalists.
And there were big names this year. Jhumpa Lahiri, Rachel Kushner, George Saunders.
Yeah, very big names.
We're missing one.
Thomas Pynchon, of
That's
course.
Right.
Who
was not there, of course.
Was not there. I don't think anyone really expected him to emerge from a half century of seclusion and attend these National Book Awards, especially since he didn't win.
Who were the favorites for fiction?
Of the most speculation, I think people really thought that it was George Saunders' year, that he had worked for so long in obscurity and that he, you know, his book, his short story collection was really...
10th of December.
Yeah, it was the cool book of the year.
You know,
I think that it would have been The Darling, and I think people really would have... love to see him win, not only because he would have had a pretty cool speech, but I think that everyone, there was a real sense that it was maybe his turn. But you heard in the room when the announcement that James McBride was the winner, you know, there was a yelp and this, you know, kind of shriek of surprise from the Riverhead table. And when McBride took the stage, he said that he hadn't even written a speech. And he did talk a little bit about, you know, his writing of the book and how he had written it amid personal tragedies. His mother had passed away, a niece had passed away, and then his marriage fell apart. And he said that in the midst of all of that, it was always nice to have somebody, you know, his characters, whose world he could just fall into and follow around.
And he doesn't read his reviews, so maybe that was part of the surprise. He didn't know just how acclaimed the book had been when
yeah.
it came out.
I mean, he certainly wasn't expecting to win because he hadn't prepared a long speech.
Let's talk about nonfiction.
So in nonfiction, George Packer, the New Yorker writer, won for The Unwinding, an Inner History of the New America. And George Packer, who, of course, is a renowned war correspondent, was cited for this book that the judges in their citation said that Packer casts a discerning eye on banks and Wall Street while tracing the painful dissolution of much of our economic infrastructure. This book was very well reviewed. It was a book that was really in a strong shortlist of finalists.
He was not the only New Yorker writer.
No, he was not. And, you know, the rap on the National Book Awards in previous years is that they were, you know, too obscure, the books were too small, no one had ever heard of them, they ignore all the big books. This was definitely not the case this year. I mean, you had Rachel Kushner, Jhumpa Lahiri, George Saunders, you know, all darlings. And the 3 of the 5 nonfiction finalists are staff writers for The New Yorker. So it was really just a choice of which New Yorker staff writer was going to win the award.
And in children's literature, another win, second win in a row for Simon and Schuster.
Yes, Cynthia Katahata won for The Thing About Luck, which was published by Simon and Schuster, which, yes, another great year for their children's division. And then the poetry award went to Mary Seibst. Forgive me if I'm mispronouncing that. And her book was published by Grey Wolf Press, which is a very good little publisher based in Minneapolis.
Moving and sort of slightly melancholy, but very moving acceptance speech.
Yeah, a little melancholy, but I think also touching. You know, she was crying or almost crying.
Yes.
You know, it was very emotional.
Let's talk about the host.
So this year was Mika Brzezinski, who is a host of Morning Joe. And, you know, I think she probably had a lot of people wishing that Andy Borowitz was up there. I mean, it's a tough job. It's not easy to be host. But, you know, she kind of started with these, like, in-jokes about Joe Scarborough. So
it was not a TV crowd.
It was not a TV crowd. It was not a cable news crowd.
Although Morning Joe, of course, did this year announce that's where the shortlists and the longlists were announced.
They did. There was a lot of synergy this year. It should be noted this was the first year that longlists were announced, which is a double-edged sword because it includes more authors and it gives more authors something to say about their books and, you know, more accolades for publishers to say they had long-listed books. But if you don't make the long list, then you can't console yourself with the fact that, well, I didn't make the short list, but I maybe almost made the short list. So there was a little bit of grumbling about that.
Well, a little bit of grumbling, but overall a happy occasion.
Yeah.
Thanks, Julie.
Thanks.
Patchett's new book is called This is the Story of a Happy Marriage, and she joins us now to talk about this new collection. Anne, thanks so much for joining us.
I'm really glad to be here. Thank you.
So this is a collection of personal essays. You and I both knew Lucy Greeley. Of course, you knew her quite well and have written about her both in a book and here. And I remember she was always a very strong advocate of being incredibly open and honest in the personal essay. And that seems to be something that you really bring to life here as well.
Yeah, actually, I hadn't thought about that, but maybe Lucy was my role model for the personal essay, because she wrote some personal essays that make these look downright generic.
Well, they were extremely raw and honest, and similarly here, these are very intimate personal essays. Did you have any trepidation about addressing some of the issues, talking about your childhood and marriage and divorce and remarriage?
Well, it was funny because I never had a lot of trepidations about writing each one. Now, I wrote each one separately, and each one didn't feel like too much of a reveal. But when I put them together and saw them sitting side by side, I did have a lot of trepidations. And for a long time, I worked on this book because I work on essays, because I love to write essays, and I thought, I'll never actually put these side by side in a book.
Because then they'll really know you.
Yeah, I say in the introduction, it's the difference between publishing a puzzle piece and publishing a map to your house.
Right. And another thing you wrote in the introduction that struck me is that that your work here bears the stamp of a writer who started out in women's magazines. Do you think that women's magazine writing sort of often gets unfairly portrayed or pigeonholed as something that maybe isn't as worthy as other types of writing?
Absolutely. And I had to really think long and hard about putting that sentence in and owning it. Yes, I got my start in women's magazines. But really, almost every woman I know either reads some woman's magazine or has at some point in her life. And there's a lot of good writing in them, and there's a lot of information and sharing and kind of validation for feelings. This notion of what women are interested in, what women write, what women read, is really not ever considered as literary, as valid as what's going on in men's literature or in men's magazines. And I thought it was probably important for me to stand up and own it.
The men's magazines being sort of the province of the serious journalism, new journalism, war reporting, et cetera, whereas the women's magazines being the province of the familial and the domestic. And
yes, but of course there's also an enormous amount of junk in men's magazines. You know, it's not that The New Yorker is not the men's magazine, it's that Esquire is the men's magazine, or GQ, or Maxim. And it's a magazine that's also, those are magazines that are also very, very much about how to get a girl and how to have flat abs and how to deal with your receding hairline. There's a lot about men's magazines, while they may seem more honorable, that are very much the stuff of women's magazines when you think about it.
When you say the stamp of women's magazines, what does that mean? What's the, in the best sense of the phrase, what does that mean to you?
It means a kind of sharing and intimacy. And saying, I'm going to really tell you about what's going on with me in my life, because maybe it will be beneficial for you on your journey. And in that sense, I'm really all for it, frankly, in every sense. I'm all for it. I'm all for women's magazines in their lowest, most entertaining moments. It's funny, I'm a person who doesn't watch any television, and I haven't since I was in high school. I just never watched television.
Even television, like as seen through a Netflix DVD?
No, I don't do that at
wow.
all.
Wow.
Yeah, none of it. Yeah, people talk about Mad Men and Breaking Bad, and I just sort of look, you know, I don't, it's not my world. But women's magazines are kind of my television. And I don't read fashion magazines anymore. I remember somebody telling me years ago, you know, you grow up and you progress to home magazines and cooking magazines.
Right.
But that really is how I unwind and relax, the way I imagine other people unwinding with television.
The book is called This is the Story of a Happy Marriage, and there is a title essay later on in the collection, which I want to talk about. But first, wanted to talk a little bit about your essay, The Sacrament of Divorce. I remember the first line of my first book was, before I got divorced, I got married forever. And you have a line in here.
Good line.
Well, you also have a great line here in the beginning of this essay. My divorce began less than a week before we were married. Which is kind of the opposite in a way, but tell us about this essay.
You know, of all the essays in the book, that was the one I didn't want to put in. It felt too personal, too old. It really made me uncomfortable. But it was also a piece, I wrote it for Vogue, I don't even remember. I know it's the oldest piece in the book. And then it was put into an anthology called The Women on Divorce. And I have, over the years, had so many people come up to me and say, I read that essay, it was really meaningful, it was really helpful. When I was putting the book together, my friend Nikki Castle, who was really so instrumental in badgering me into doing this project when I felt like I couldn't do it and it was too personal, that was one of the essays that I immediately took out. And she kept saying, you have to put it back in, it's really important. And the book's only been out 3 weeks, but it's been interesting to me because it's the essay, again, that people are coming up and saying, that was really meaningful to me. I'm really glad that I read that. And I think that that's part of it. You know, it's that, are you willing to open something up in yourself so that other people can find some comfort in their own experience.
Yeah, it's interesting because that's another thing that had come up with Lucy Greeley, also back to Lucy, but she, there was always this topic of when you write a personal essay, it's not just about you, it's about these other people. And, you know, is it fair to write about someone else when, you know, sort of they didn't ask to be written about? And she sort of took the position of, again, total honesty, total openness, and that you write about your experience and that necessarily involves other people. But did you have some concern about not just opening up your own life, but that of you, as you say in your essay, you call him your ex-husband half the time, but your husband the other half of the time. Did you think about, you know, the repercussions of writing about these things on not just him, but also in other essays, the other people in your life?
I did think about it. Of course, and I really have to say, I did exactly what Lucy always did, which is the story that you tell is maybe 15% of what actually happened.
Mm-hmm.
So if my ex-husband read this book, which I can't imagine, or anyone in my family who has read this book, they read the essay with a certain sense of gratitude that I didn't tell the whole story. And I know that Lucy did that. She used to say all the time, after everybody in my family is dead, I'll write Autobiography of a Face, you know, volume 2, and tell what really happened.
And you wrote a book about your friendship with Lucy, and then you returned to that here. What did you feel that you, what did, else did you want to say about it that wasn't in the book?
Well, I think that Truth and Beauty was a book about Lucy, and the essays in this book are about things that happened to me because of Truth and Beauty. It really isn't so much about going back to that story, but the aftermath mm-hmm. of things that happened because of the book after she died.
There's always the book and then the story of after the book.
Yes, that's true.
Tell us about the story of A Happy Marriage.
When I was putting this book together, I really wanted to write some long essays. I started to think of the essay collection as kind of a shopping mall, and that I had the boutique stores and I needed the anchor stores. I needed some really, really big pieces to kind of pin the whole thing into place. And so I wrote a long piece about writing advice called The Getaway Car, a long piece about the Los Angeles Police Department. And then this piece, this is the story of A Happy Marriage. Audible had come to me and asked me to write a very long piece as an Audible original, their first thing that had been written just for Audible. And again, going back to Nikki Castle, went to her and said, I don't know what to write about for this long piece. And she was in her 20s and said, you're my one friend who has a happy marriage. And my friends and I are all dating and we're on the internet and we're kind of trying to figure out how to do this, how to grow up, how to be married. And I would really like to know what your secret is, you know, what makes your marriage to Carl a happy marriage. And I thought that was a really good idea. And so I sat down to write the essay and then was confronted by the long history of divorce in my family. And really coming to realize that everything that I know about marriage was built on the bedrock of divorce. And so that essay was really, really hard to write. And I kept telling myself the whole way through, just write it. And if it doesn't work out, if people in your family are hurt by it, you can throw it away. But you need to write it. And I let my husband read it and my mother read it and my stepfather read it. And they were all fine. So I went forward.
Before we go, I just want to talk a minute about Parnassus Books, the store that you co-own in Nashville. There is, of course, a small tradition of novelists who own bookstores. You know, when you opened Parnassus, it seemed that the entire community of writers and publishers was just so grateful and thrilled that you had gone ahead and done this. What do you think you bring to owning a bookstore as a writer yourself?
For Parnassus itself, what I bring is a Rolodex. Now, I know everybody in the business. There really isn't a writer. If I don't know the writer, I know their agent or I know their editor, and I can get people to come to Nashville, and I can provide a really vibrant literary community coming through the bookstore because of the work that I've been doing in my life. And that's great. But in a larger sense, I am the person who goes out on book tour or when I give talks night after night and can say to people, my message boils down to the lowest price isn't necessarily the best value. What do we get by spending $4 or $5 more for a book in a bookstore? We get a community center. We get someplace to bring our kids. We get a smart staff to talk to. We get to see authors. We get the sense of community and interaction. And that if we like that and appreciate it, then it's our responsibility to take care of it and support it. And I don't know exactly why that's my job, but I seem to be the person to be able to say that to people. You know, stop and think about where you're spending your money and what's important to you. You want to have jobs in your community, you want to have tax base, then get off your iPad and stop tapping up everything you want and go into your community and support your local businesses. It's not that I want you to support my local independent bookstore. I want you to support your local independent bookstore.
Well, they're still there. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. I've had a wonderful time, and thanks for the great review. I really appreciate it.
Of course. The book is reviewed this week by Wendy Lesser, and it is called, again, This is the Story of a Happy Marriage. Ann Patchett, thanks again.
Thanks, Pamela.
Greg Coles has bestseller news. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Pamela.
What's new on the list?
Let's look at the hardcover lists, starting on the fiction side of things, where we have a new book at number one. It is The First Phone Call from Heaven by Mitch Albom. Mitch Albom, of course, a longtime Detroit sports writer who then went on to write Tuesdays with Morrie and has now written kind of a string of somewhat sappy spiritual novels.
Not his first bestseller.
not by a long shot. And this continues that trend in which a small Michigan town starts receiving phone calls that seem to be from heaven. That's new at number one. Then at number three, another new book is Patricia Cornwell's Dust. This continues her K. Scarpetta series. At number four, a book called White Fire. It's by Douglas Preston and Lincoln Child. It's the 13th book in their Pendergast series, the special agent Aloysius Pendergast of the FBI. It's a little bit of a departure for them because it opens up all the way back in the 19th century with Oscar Wilde and Arthur Conan Doyle, and then ties in a current day Pendergast mystery with the deaths of some miners that took place back in that time.
Mm-hmm.
Then there's just one other new book on the fiction list this week. It's down at number 12. It's Tatiana by Martin Cruz Smith, who, of course, wrote Gorky Park and has recently revealed that he has Parkinson's disease. He's been fighting that.
So that's a lot of new books by very established bestseller.
Yeah, four
authors.
New books, all by real brand names. That's right.
And on nonfiction?
Two books on the nonfiction side of things this week. Also real
familiar
brand
names. Familiar names, yes.
Not necessarily as authors, but familiar in other spheres. At number nine, Good Tidings and Great Joy by the former vice presidential candidate and talking head Sarah Palin. This is a pro-Christmas book. It's one of these War on Christmas type books saying we put the Christ back in Christmas. It also includes recipes for Rice Krispie treats and moose chili and other things. At number 14, the former heavyweight champion Mike Tyson has written a book with Larry Sloman. It's a memoir called Undisputed Truth, which is also the name of his TV show. And this is truly a straight-up memoir, kind of looking back at his rough childhood. He was a bullied kind of fat kid who started training to be a boxer and turned out to be really, really good at it. And he talks about his persona as Iron Mike, you know, how he became really vicious and both in the ring and out of the ring, as partly as a strategy to intimidate his opponents.
Who says you need to be a writer to be on the bestseller list?
Yeah.
All right. Well, thanks, Greg.
Thanks, Pamela.
Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. Our producer is Jocelyn Gonzalez, and you can always write to us at books@nytimes.com. Thanks for listening. For the New York Times, I'm Pamela Paul.